Hello, everybody. Welcome, and thank you for joining us today, Saturday afternoon here in America, Sunday morning to those of you calling in from New Zealand. I wanted just to say a few technical things and give an overview of the my camera's not on. All right. Hi there. I wanted to remind everybody that we're being recorded. So when you speak, you're agreeing to that so that we can make this available for people who want to check in archived. And I also wanted to ask that you fill out the evaluation that you get at the end, because it really does help us to make this better and meet the needs that you all express. And then in terms of how to do this today, so that we can really hear from and see as many of you as possible, the way it works is please use the chat for comments and to share resources with each other. And then use the Q&A to get the questions to us or to Duncan, or just comments that you want to discuss publicly with us. And then if you would please, if you have any technical issues, please send an email to Mitch, and the address is events@thrivemovement.com. That really helps kind of keep things sorted on our end, because a lot of things are coming in from all directions. And if you would be so kind as to let him know if the tech issue gets resolved, it's a much more satisfying experience. And in terms of making yourself available to be on video, GOA will make you a panelist, and you'll exit the full screen mode and click on the green camera icon next to your name. And if you could locate that now, it would be super helpful, because then it won't take so long once we recognize you and try to bring you in. You'll be unmuted. And so please try and keep it succinct, where, you know, maybe a minute for questions and 2 minutes for comments, and then that way we'll have more of you be able to participate. The way it's going to happen today is, first I'm going to hand off to Foster, who's going to do an introduction about getting beyond left and right, and he'll have some maybe about a half an hour of that. And then also he is going to be, and then we'll interact with you for some comments and questions. And then we're going to introduce a fabulous guest we have today, Duncan Rhodes, the founder of the Alternative News Project, which is super exciting, and which Foster will also tell you more about. And then we will have more interaction where you can interact with Duncan and with us and with each other. And then also I wanted to say that I will be offering a vision of what it's like beyond left and right, in response to the evaluation and the comments that you've given. It seems that that really is a valuable thing to do. So I've created one for this event as well. So Foster, handing off to you. And thanks again for everyone being here.
Okay. Thank you, everyone, for taking this time on a Saturday to be together. We just love to be able to have this kind of conversation with you, and I'll be as succinct as I can, but I do want to take some time up front here. I want to take probably about 25 minutes to just lay out some perspective about how we interact with news. People have been asking us for years, and we finally have taken the time to really do an analysis of that. People seem to be finding it of value to take a look at the ideas that we're suggesting. And in my presentation today, I'm going to really look at three major questions. The first one is, how do we get our news? And the second one is, how do we then evaluate the news that we get? And finally, how do we use that to determine our actions? What are the compasses by which we determine how to take action in a highly leveraged and effective way? So I actually want to start by sharing a little bit of my political history that I don't think I've actually ever done before publicly. But I think it's very relevant to my experience of this whole left and right conundrum. I was born and raised in Ohio. I grew up in a very Republican district of southern Ohio, where I got the clear impression, looking back, that Democrats were, you know, either ignorant or immoral or both, you know, if not downright evil. That was never said, but that was the impression that I clearly was given. I even at one point as a teenager, I helped one of my father's good friends with his successful bid for the U.S. Senate from Ohio. I had no clue what I was doing, but he was a good guy, and I was going around to county fairs, and it was an interesting process. But then something happened. I discovered that my dear grandmother, who I just loved and loved to talk with, I found out someone whispered to me that she was a Democrat. So I was a little stunned by this, and so I made a point of taking her aside privately and asking her about it. And she said that she would never discuss politics openly because people would make fun of her or ostracize her for her views. And she told me that the real turning point for her had been her experience of President Franklin D. Roosevelt. She said that he seemed like a good man who had really worked to help get people out of the Depression, that he had spearheaded a fight for victory over the Nazis, and she thought he was a really good man. So that stuck with me. It was actually, in retrospect, my first glimpse beyond the unspoken agreement of political tribalism. And I've come to realize that political partyism, if you want to call it that, is actually a lot like racism. Now, I personally was never that interested in politics myself. I found it stifling. I found it fake. But I really cared about causes. And after college, when I moved to Northern California, I found myself surrounded by mostly liberal and progressive Democrats. And frankly, over time, I became very impressed with their compassion for the poor, with their strong anti-Vietnam War stance, and with their defense of civil and women's rights. And I ended up voting mostly Democrat or independent for the next three decades. But it was still specific causes that really captured my interest and on which I spent most of my time. So I began learning about the depth of corruption then throughout politics on both sides, and I became deeply uncomfortable about the demonization of both Republicans and Democrats by seemingly well-intended good people. People that I knew and loved in California and Ohio, I would go back and forth between the states, and I would hear them talking with such vitriol about the people from the other party. And frankly, many on both sides that I met would not dream of going to a social gathering with people from the so-called other side. And at the same time, I knew that they all cared deeply and really shared so many values. And as well, I was observing that the control of power would swing back from one side to the other, but basically things were getting mostly worse. And the only occasional glimpses of real change that I was noticing came mostly from grassroots movements to reclaim natural rights rather than political ideologies struggling for power. So I want to take a moment before we go into the next question about where do we get our news. And if you would, I'd like to take a moment for anyone who would like to participate in a poll. So Go, if you could bring that up on the screen and tell people where that will be.
Sure. Which poll are we doing? The bias?
This is going to be, do you primarily identify yourself as, and you will see options of conservative, liberal, libertarian, Green Party, independent, other, or I don't vote. So we would appreciate it if you would choose the one that you most primarily identify with and just click on that and hit submit. And that we should be able to do that pretty quickly, and then we'll get some feedback. I have no interest individually in what party anyone is or whatever, but I am interested in just kind of getting a sense of the spectrum of who happens to be on this call. I know in our network we have a vast number of people from all these different parties or no party at all. And that's one of the things I really love about being able to talk to our network, and especially about a topic like this.
Okay, looks like everybody's finished. I'm going to close the poll.
Okay, we should be getting some results here in a moment. I've begun asking this at my public talks. I let people close their eyes in case they're embarrassed or feel awkward about talking about what their stand is, but it ends up being really helpful. Okay, so you can see that graph there. Large liberal, some conservative, libertarian, and green, a very large independent group, some other, and a sizable no answer, and also a pretty strong group that does not vote. Okay, so that's the kind of cross-section that I was referring to. So thanks for doing that. So let me go on to our second question. Where do we get our news? And I'd like to refer you to the blog that we put out this last week. If any of you haven't seen that, if you go to thrivemovement.com and just go to Foster and Kimberly's blog section and click on the most recent blog, at the end of that blog, we make a list. It's a partial list, but it's about 70 different news sources that we constantly track. And I'll go into that more in a moment. But let me just mention to you once again, historically, where we live now in Northern California. Our mail carrier one day confided to Kimberly that we were the one house that she couldn't figure out until Thrive came out, because we got magazines and journals from the whole spectrum, from liberal, conservative, libertarian, voluntarist, as well as journals from the areas of science, environment, economics, you know, health, and other things. So that's been really helpful to us to be constantly monitoring a spectrum of perspectives. And I want to talk about the word partisan for a moment. You know, partisan thinking, partisan acting has clearly taken us, at least in the United States, but in most countries that I follow, into political gridlock, both locally, nationally, and around the world. Now, a lot of people are making more and more bipartisan efforts. That's an effort to compromise between the parties. And, you know, we've gotten a few more new laws and new taxes appropriated from the income of hardworking citizens. I don't know how much of a plus that has been, but I applaud the efforts. And politics itself has taken us to the brink of catastrophe, nuclear, financial, and environmental. So we suggest that it's time to take a step back and take a really profound, what we would call transpartisan look into and beyond politics itself, if we want to survive, much less thrive. Now, the word transpartisan, I looked it up, and it's not in most dictionaries yet, and I think that's a telltale sign. So I hope that we can help to spread its launch. The dictionary describes partisan in two ways. The military has its own definition, which means someone who is a member of a party or of troops engaged in harassing an enemy. I find it's very useful sometimes to find the roots of words, because it tends to carry forward in their use. The civilian definition is a person who shows a biased emotional allegiance to a group, party, or cause. Now, since both left and right politics in my research has always led eventually to tyranny, whether it's communist or socialist or democratic or fascist, and nearly all news outlets seem to be propaganda arms for either liberals or conservatives, how do we find out what's going on without just getting duped by more political manipulation? Now, let me refer one more time to the blog that we put out last week. In that blog, we divided our sources for news and perspectives, and we just reflected on it in this country. It's just too broad to go outside the country, even though a lot of these outlets are covering news from all over the world. And we put it into the topics of liberty, of global domination agenda, of liberal sources, conservative sources, financial sources, new science, consciousness, mainstream news, and then a small section called comprehensive understanding. And all we've really got in that so far is Thrive Movement and the Alternative News Project. And the head of the Alternative News Project, Duncan Rhodes, is on with us today, and we're going to ask him to talk a little bit about his project after I finish and after we take a couple of questions. So let's move on to how do we evaluate the news that we get. And before we go any further with that, I want to take another poll. Go, if you would put the second one up. This one you'll see is, what bias do you most tend to carry into choosing, excluding, and evaluating your news sources?
Foster, first, it's, are you aware of a bias that you bring?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, that's right. This is a two-part one. Thank you, Kimberly. So the first question is, are you conscious of a bias that you bring to choosing, excluding, and responding to news sources? So that should be just a yes or no. And then in the second one, what bias do you most tend to carry into that act? And you'll see the choices are patriotism, an ethnic group, a religious sect, your political party, the financial impact that news might have on your life, morality, or the credentials of the source. And what we mean by that is kind of traditional credentials. Are they an official, you know, licensed journalist with a mainstream type of outlet? Okay, so take a moment, answer those two questions, please. We find this really helpful to just invite people to do what we do, to self-reflect so that you know your own bias. Usually it's hardest for us to see our own bias, even though most others can see it more clearly than we can. But if you know you've got one, it's a lot easier to have your bias and be able to see beyond and around it rather than just be had by your bias and think that it means that only people who agree with a particular perspective, you know, have any value. Okay, Goa, how are we doing on the submissions on that?
Almost done. There's only a few more people still in progress. That's seven folks.
Oh, one of them is me. Hold on. Okay. All right.
Okay, results are coming right up. There you go.
And if you're looking at the results, you can put your cursor over one of the lines in the row that says questions, results, bar graph. You can put your cursor on one of those lines and expand to the right, and you'll be able to see more. Well, I really appreciate people's candor about being conscious of a bias. And it looks like the strongest response is in morality and credentials, with some responses in the other groups as well. Okay, that's very helpful. Thank you for taking the time to self-reflect in that way. So let me talk for a moment about some of the ways that we try to discern truth. Kimberly said at one time she would way rather have a full-time fact checker than a house cleaner any day. We had two professional independent fact checkers working on Thrive, and it was so helpful and enlightening about the process and the result, and no one has been able to challenge a single fact out of 183 major facts in that film. None of them have been able to be challenged or shown to be inaccurate. I wish we had full-time fact checkers the whole time. But we learned a lot from them how to go about fact checking. So we spend as much time as we can on that. And especially trying to go to original sources and then to cross-correlate information if you can't get to an original source, to cross-correlate with our most reliable sources. And it can fool you sometime. We've found a lot of times people like to make fun of people like David Icke or Alex Jones because, you know, they've got a ranting style and they talk about wild things that a lot of people don't believe in and that type of thing. We found the two of them to be right at the top of our most reliable sources whenever it came to facts. You know, hopefully they're distinguishing, and they often do, between facts and speculation. But cross-correlating with sources who have proven themselves over the years to just be relatively extremely trustworthy is really helpful. The next one is just common sense. Common sense can keep us skeptical without being cynical. If there are things that just sound too good to be true or too wild to really be grounded, you can leave it in the skeptical area where I don't know. You know, one of my main guiding words these days is maybe. So I just leave a lot in that area where common sense tells me, probably not, but I don't know that it's not. So then moving on, we ask ourselves all the time from a story, you know, in the Latin phrase is cui bono, who's benefiting? And best way to find that out is try to follow the money like we did in Thrive. An example of that is I just kind of hold my nose and watch the one or two of the Sunday morning TV talk shows, the political talk shows, almost every week, or I tape them and watch them later on. And I really watch the ads a lot, or at least I register who's sponsoring them, because the biggest players and the Sunday morning talk shows and the nightly news, they just provide a blitz of commercials from, A, the pharmaceuticals like Merck, Pfizer, Bayer, the banks, Chase, Citigroup, B of A, Goldman Sachs, and the military-industrial complex, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, Halliburton. So we encourage you to pay attention to the ads. You know, who's paying for the filter that's coming out on the news? You know, whose drum do you think they're marching to? And the ads are a good way to find out. And the final thing I'd say about that is we, for myself, I try to always hold up two lenses to the news. One is from the lens of the global domination agenda. How would the presentation of this particular set of facts or set of opinions, how might it serve the global domination agenda, which tends to be run by the bankers, the corporate leaders, and the political and military leaders who are running the global domination agenda? And the second one is the more fun one to look through is the Taurus lens. Those of you who know from our film, the Taurus is the pattern of wholeness. So when I look at a story about GMOs or chemtrails or banking schemes, I look to see, okay, is the system being described, is it a whole system or is it a whole system that has been destroyed, that has been broken down and is no longer functioning in a way that is healthy for the economy, that's healthy for the environment, that's healthy for individuals? And finally, I'll say we try to ask ourselves in relation to any of these news sources, what are they saying? Why are they saying it? And what is their proposed or implied solution? You know, a lot of these so-called formal journalists, you know, are not allowed to suggest any solution. They're not even allowed to have an opinion. But it's usually pretty clear with who they have on or what the perspective of their pundits is, you know, what the implied right perspective or implied solution is. And we ask ourselves, even with the alternative media outlets who aren't beholden necessarily to advertisers or even to political parties, we ask ourselves, is their solution orientation based on political power or is it based on sound ethical principles? Does it empower me or does it tend to give my power over to some so-called authority? You know, the big problem with the vast majority of the media, I find, particularly in the mainstream, is that while they may be really skilled at exposing the coercion and the deception of their opponents' actions, they hide their own by either not recommending solutions at all, or when they do, it becomes clear that they have nothing more to offer or to recommend than their own version of the communism, socialism, fascism, or majority rule democracy that has already been tried and doesn't work, or at least doesn't work fully or well, and that history has shown, in fact, leads eventually, even if it takes 200 years, to tyranny, torture, and the murder of millions of innocent human beings. I'll never forget on a Sunday talk show recently, I was watching, and there was this debate going on between those from the right and those from the left, and they finally reached this place where they all threw up their hands and acknowledged that they had no idea how to get out of this mess. Now, from my point of view, more of that would be a really good start. I personally believe that there is no way out of this mess as long as the debate is about who should rule, because in my mind, no one should rule. Okay, in talking beyond left and right, which we end up doing with a lot of audiences, with our families, with our friends and so forth, the most important thing we have found is, number one, to ask questions, and number two, to focus on shared values. Because we've learned in our own experience and from people like Larkin Rose, who've been leading workshops on this, that usually over 95%, the people that you can talk to who disagree on political parties, they agree on values over 95%. They share a vision of a world where people have enough of what they need to enjoy life and they're free to fulfill their dreams, you know, to care for one another. They talk about peace and justice and security. They want a healthy environment. They want peaceful lives. They want meaningful friendships for themselves and for others, and they want creative expression. They talk about love. They talk about love in relationships. They talk about integrity in transactions. And they talk about the fundamental freedom that everyone wants to do as they please, free from coercion, threat, or violence. So ask yourself for a moment, is this in fact true for you? Do you share those values, at least for yourself? Because in our observation, the breakdown doesn't come usually in values. It comes in different strategies for how to realize those goals. So, how do millions of very smart and caring people stay trapped in this false left-right choice at our own peril? So, that leads to the next area here. Let's take a look at some of the mouthpieces for the compelling media propaganda that keeps so many of us not only enthralled and entertained, but also deluded. So let's take a look at some of the kind of mainstream media mouthpieces that we all encounter to whatever degree you expose yourself to that. Mostly what we all see when we look at the mainstream news is an endless drama. There's this rapid turnover of the news cycle of, you know, by the time you start to wrap around the last event, the implications of a particular murder or a particular vote or some sort of drama, the news cycle has moved on to the next one before there can really be any resolution or any really oftentimes key insights. And it's left in this right-left conflict. So let's start looking first an overview. At the grand scale of highly visible and highly funded political news, we've got people like Rush Limbaugh, Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity, and Fox News on the right, the people that the left love to hate. On the left, we've got CNN, MSNBC, The New York Times, Rachel Maddow, Amy Goodman, Jon Stewart, Bill Maher. Now we've got a humorous edition with John Oliver. Now, some of you may have been thinking, and I agree, I haven't been able to find the right-wing humor shows. And I think it's an interesting reflection on our society. I think they balance that out. I think it's a little harder to make the humor with the right-wing perspective, but they balance it out with the domination of AM radio, particularly if you've traveled in the Midwest at all by car, by very serious religious fundamentalism. So one thing that I find that most of these famous news outlets or commentators are good at is shining a light on the weaknesses, the contradictions, the corruption, and the immorality of the so-called other side. And that's one of the main reasons, frankly, that I listen to them. Another is that listening to corporate and foundation-funded news shows me not so much what's happening, but what are the big institutions and the money men want me to believe is going on, and how do they want me to think about it? On the right, Limbaugh and Hannity and O'Reilly do actually, in my observation, a remarkably astute job of taking apart the sanctimonious excuses for the tsunami of socialism from the Obama regime. Rush Limbaugh impales the partisan, what he calls drive-by media of the left, point by point, and frankly, few try to refute him, preferring to just kind of wail away at the easy targets, his arrogance, his size, his prescription drug addiction, because actually most of what he's saying about liberal deceptions and creeping Marxism is probably right on when viewed with an open, transpartisan mind. Now, all three of these guys, in my opinion, are bullies, and they will interrupt anyone they have on their show if they start making intelligent arguments against their position. But at the same time, they skillfully take apart in certain aspects of perpetual entitlements, the takeover of healthcare, education, and so forth. And they're strikingly silent on corporate subsidies, on bailouts, on war, on the real truth behind banking. And their solutions, as far as I can tell, have been shown not to work either. Another interesting one to look at on the right is Alex Jones. Now, a lot of people don't like to listen to Alex, and I understand it, because he's very shrill. He gets wild and angry when he goes into his rants. He's hard to listen to. And from my perspective, he's limited somewhat by his allegiance to the church and the state. And the solutions is not his focus, so it can be a little overwhelming. But my observation also, as I mentioned before, that he's closer to the truth about what's really going on than almost anyone on the radio. I ask people sometimes when they complain about him, if you had been in colonial America at the time of the revolution and Paul Revere had come riding through your town, shrieking about the British were coming, would you have ignored him because his voice was shrill or his horse was sweaty and smelly? We would avoid what Alex is saying at our own peril. Okay, let's look for a moment at the left. And I've looked into this so much. I've got way more to say than I'll be able to squeeze in here, but I just want to hit some highlights on both sides to just give a sense of the process that we go through. People like Maddow and Maurer and Goodman, Stewart and Oliver, they, from my perspective, masterfully expose the excesses of the right. They lay bare the crony corporatism with its subsidies and bailouts. They take on the warmongering on behalf of the multinational corporations in a way that the right usually won't do, as well as religious and social intolerance. And whether it's through sarcasm and wit in their case, or with like Goodman does with good old-fashioned partisan muckraking activism, they show us every day the greed, the destruction of the right-wing drive to control everyone in the bedroom, in the boardroom, and on the imperialistic battlefield. And I find that very helpful, even though it's also challenging to listen to. Amy Goodman's a perfect example. I've listened to Amy Goodman most mornings for over a decade. And I find her to be very good. Her show, Democracy Now!, the subtitle is The War and Peace Report. And she's quite good about anti-war perspectives. But at the same time, she supports the government and the taxes that the government needs to go and wage those wars, even when 90% of the population doesn't agree with the wars. And she resists usually talking too much about solutions unless she's giving a talk or writing a book. But it's clear from most of the guests that she has on and her expressions that her ideal solutions are socialist or progressive. And, we've seen to a great extent throughout history how dangerous the socialist solutions are. Amy, apparently won't go near the 9/11 facts. She will rarely touch into the false flag events or really talk about what's going on in the Federal Reserve beyond just basic corruption. And It's also risky for someone like her to go after the bankers too much, because she gets a lot of her funding from the very bankers that we describe in Thrive. And this, you know, could be one reason why she actively lobbied, we were told, to keep Thrive from being shown on the ironically named Free Speech TV. So Bill Maher is another example. Bill Maher gave $1 million to Obama's PAC for the last election. He's, you know, proudly partisan to the left. But at the same time, he finally admitted on his show one night, I don't know how many people caught it, but he finally said, when he was really pressed on certain issues, he said, you know, I'm actually more of a libertarian. But I think in his case, he's actually more talking about, he doesn't think that people should be prohibited from smoking or selling marijuana, which I agree with. But that, I don't think, really establishes someone as a true freedom lover. And then one day on his show, he said, I don't really know what the big fuss is about on the Federal Reserve. I don't even know what it does. So a couple of shows later, the actor, comedian Richard Belzer came on. And Belzer basically schooled him on what the Federal Reserve was really doing and all the corruption involved. And the subject was quickly changed, and I've never heard it come up again. And I've continued to watch it every show for years. Russell Brand is another one. I love Russell Brand. He cracks me up. I think he's charming. I think he's brilliant. I love his courage in taking on the establishment. And at the same time, I read his book very carefully, and I've really looked in a lot of his, what he calls the truths, supposed truth-telling videos that he does online, and they are very compelling. It's just that if you're aware beyond the partisan divide, his solutions are very frustrating. In his book, Revolution, one quote from the book is that individualism was an old primitive idea. We're at a moment in history where consciousness is going to coalesce and collectivize. The practical, fair allocation of resources must be prioritized. In other words, collectivism and authoritarian redistribution of wealth. And I know, I really believe that I know his heart, that he wants to see everyone happy and healthy. But this is the exact same thinking as Marx, Stalin, Mussolini, Mao, and many more, that has led to, you know, over 100 million murders within state societies just in the 20th century alone. That's not even including wars. So I won't take much more time to go into that, but Brand, he comes so close. I really feel like he's got the aroma of liberty, and it's really drawing him on. He loves Mahatma Gandhi talking about self-governance, you know, what Gandhi called Hind Swaraj. But then very quickly after that, he just falls into this kind of fashionable adoration of people like Castro and Che Guevara and John Maynard Keynes and Thomas Piketty, all of whom are, you know, socialists, if not communists, and have proven it in their writings and in their actions. Brand goes on to say, we must always prioritize our collective well-being above individual. No individual has authority. The group has authority. The group conscience is expressed through voting. And the utilities and facilities of major corporations can be confiscated and given to democratic collectives. Again, really well-intentioned, and people cheer when he says this kind of stuff if they haven't studied their history and know the kind of tyranny, you know, torture and murder that this leads to. Now, the final person I'll just mention briefly is Chris Hedges. I am a huge fan of Chris Hedges. I read everything he does. He came to Santa Cruz recently, and we had a chance to meet with him, and I got to talk with him for a little while. And here's a sample of the way Chris, who's a former New York Times reporter and just a famous, courageous foreign war correspondent. Chris wrote at one point, "We now live in a nation where doctors destroy health, lawyers destroy justice, universities destroy knowledge, governments destroy freedom, the press destroys information, religion destroys morals, and our banks destroy the economy." That is a lot of heavy insight. And he goes on to say, all systems of power seek to obscure truth. But if you go on to read Chris, I don't think he has awareness of the possibility of moving into a society with rules, but without the traditional authoritarian rulers. Why would we give a system like the socialist systems that he recommends power when he says all systems of power seek to obscure the truth? He's great on exposing both right and left corruption, great on journalism, on endless war, on child trafficking. But when he goes to look for a moral code, he, like Alex Jones, his two major allegiances are to the church and to the state. So he looks to his particular God to see what the commandments are, rather than actually come up with a rational moral ethic that doesn't have to depend on one's own particular interpretation of, you know, the word of the divine. And he's also strongly anti-capitalist, even though he goes on to admit we are not, in fact, in a laissez-faire capitalism, but corporate socialism. So a lot of that is what needs to be unpacked, and we're going to be unpacking this in coming weeks, is when somebody takes down capitalism, they're usually really well-intended in talking about evil corruption, but they don't understand the difference between corporate cronyism, state intervention capitalism, as they call it, and actual voluntary exchange protecting the rights of individuals. Okay. Maybe later on in the Q&As, I'll go into some more of the details of the correlations between the socialist agenda and the Communist Manifesto or the right-wing agenda and the history of fascism. But I think you get enough of that. So let me just finish with looking at the third question, which is, how do we determine our actions? If we're trying to look beyond right and left, what do we look to? Now, recently at an event in Santa Cruz, it was a wonderful event. We're very politically oriented or action oriented. A woman came up to me at the end of the event. I was just in the audience, and she said that she wanted to congratulate Kimberly and me and our team on our film. She said, "I just loved your movie, except at the end when you started talking about this true freedom stuff and the non-aggression principle and moving beyond authoritarian government." She finally ended by saying, "Don't we have to have someone to rule us?" And this was a woman in her 60s or 70s who had been a longtime, wonderful, dedicated activist. And so this is really the critical question that one by one we're all having to face. Don't we have to have someone to rule us? In my experience, when we give authoritarian permission, when we give our power over to the right or the left, it always ends up in fascism, because the state, of course, always wants to combine with the corporations, because then they can pool the tax money with the corporate money and then use it to force and control the masses. So we have to swim upstream into these assumptions on both the right and left to get any sense of how to get out of this partisan gridlock, because they're all based fundamentally on violence. If you take people's money without their permission and then think you can tell them what to do, that's theft and that's coercion. And that was a surprising notion to me when someone said it, and it took me probably 2 or 3 months to unpack that and realize that finally, yeah, that's actually as obvious as 2 plus 2 is 4 once you look at it. It's just that the implications can be very challenging to one's worldview and to taking responsibility for that knowledge. What do we do about that? So we will begin in the next event on May 8th that we'll talk about a little later on. It's going to be really kind of an intro to this whole liberty perspective beyond right and left, and we'll be exploring in detail the trends, not only the philosophy, the ethics, the logic of it, but we'll be exploring what we see as a really practical and viable path to transition from where we are now to a truly free world. So in summary, let me just say, in a nutshell, on the left, we've fundamentally got state socialism. It sounds great. The words are all about fairness and equality and taking care of people, and it's usually well-intended, but it's based on coercion, and history shows that it's catastrophically destructive and even lethal. On the right, once again, well-intended, good-hearted people, for the most part, we have state corporatism. It obviously doesn't work because it's still based on violence, deception, cronyism, and it's not a true free market. The cancer virus of authoritarianism is still at its core. The option that we see beyond either of these eventually as we transition is voluntarism, which lifts off of the political spectrum that is all based on coercion and violence, or, you know, mob rule on majority where, you know, potentially 49% is still being coerced. And we find that it's actually morally coherent. And the evidence is consistent throughout history that when it's given a chance, it works to produce increased freedom, prosperity, and security when given a chance. The state usually likes to come down on it. Some state wants to come down on it very fast and take advantage of the tax base that gets produced with all that freedom and creativity and prosperity. But there are countless pieces of evidence, you know, stories throughout history that we're writing about in an upcoming book that Kimberly and I are working on and we'll be talking about in future events that show how successful this can be. And there are people, not so much in the mainstream news, probably the only one left in the mainstream, most of them have been fired now, but probably the only one left is John Stossel that I found on Fox News. He's a true, you know, liberty thinker, and I'm curious to see how much longer he'll last. But check out his show if you haven't, The Stossel Report. But people like Stefan Molyneux with Freedom Radio and Larkin Rose and Mary Ruart and Josie the Outlaw, Lou Rockwell. These people are in the resources list that we provided in the last blog. And the last thing I want to leave you with is just this kind of sequence that I have found to be absolutely vital in coming up with moral and effective solutions. Since values seem to be the common ground of non-evil human beings, we've got to realize that having values that we're committed to, since governments, which is usually the strategy, are based on coercion under the threat of violence. What we suggest is that the ethical principles on which the solutions can be based are fundamentally integrity and non-aggression, of course, except in true self-defense, is if one is unable to resolve conflict nonviolently. So the strategies we employ must align with these principles. And the tactics, the actions that we take must not coerce. That's one of the only two requirements for being a part of the Thrive Solutions Hub, is that your tactics, your actions, your solutions cannot be based on forcing or coercing anyone else. Because the results will reflect the means. And we won't get to nonviolence. We won't get to peace through initiating violence, no matter what side you're on or how many people agree with you. So thankfully, in my research, what I found is that the path of non-aggression is actually the only one that in the long run works. So, you know, thank goodness, what a wonderful universe that happens to be what really works. So, okay, I want to end there. Thank you for your attention. And I want to take a couple of questions just to begin the interaction. After a couple of questions or comments, then I'll introduce Duncan Rhodes and bring him on to do a presentation about what he's doing as well. So, Kimberly, let's open it up to questions.
Okay. Thank you for that, Foster. One thing I just want to add in how I go about this with the left and the right is that I think getting from where we are to a world that where people are truly empowered and where we're working on a principle basis and that there are rules but not rulers, that's so far from where we are, that it's the transition of getting from here to there that I'm just so fundamentally an activist that I'm always looking for strategic action. And a lot of that is where I get the value out of the left and the right, because I think that in each of the perspectives, there's really valuable stuff for how to navigate between here and a truly free world, because I don't see it as something that we say, oh, geez, I got it. We're there now. We're not there now. There's a lot of work to do between here and there. And I really find value in both the left and right actions as well as philosophies. And that's something that we'll talk about as we start to unpack this. And I wanted to correct that the event's on May 9th.
Thank you.
So that that's actually where we're going to start to do this. But let's go ahead. So we'll get to Duncan in a minute, but I just wanted to bring up Sky, who had a comment about Twin Oaks I thought you could share.
Yeah. Twin Oaks community has been around since the late 60s, and it's totally an anarchy volunteerism society. It's the only one that I've known that is still around.
Great.
But it's a very small community. It's 100 people or less. Mm-hmm. I think that most people like Russell Brand and Chris Hedges and myself a lot too, where we get stuck is we know where we want to go, but we don't know how to dismantle the government and get there.
Right.
So,
Sky, do you have a website for Twin Oaks community?
Yeah, I do. I can put it in chat.
Yeah, that'd be great. Thanks.
Yeah.
Okay.
Any resources like that that people have would be great. So, let's see. There's a bunch coming up here. Let's go with Bill Schaefer and then Mike Lilly, and then let's introduce Duncan, and then we'll come back for some more. So if you can get your camera going. Bill Schaefer.
Camera on here.
Great, thank you.
I had to have my wife. My camera icon
should be a little green icon across from your name.
Oh, there we go. I don't want to press the camera. Okay.
All right. Yay.
Thank you so much.
I raised the question of subjective morale, and I thought Foster had well addressed that, but it's still a problem for me. My son and I have had great debates about this.
Yeah.
And the problem is it's all part of our worldview, if not our spiritual view. But subjective morality versus true morality really gets to the heart of the matter.
Right.
And I guess my comment is that's a lot of us seem to use that as the yardstick we measure our multimedia experience with, yet the consciousness is the true morality, is the way I see it. How do you see us filtering?
I think it's a great question. I don't know of any more important question than that. And interestingly enough, Bill, the person who really opened my eyes first on this whole issue was my son. And it was in the... Yeah, I mean, it's really important to listen to this younger generation because they may not have been here as long, but they're standing on the shoulders of prior generations, and they've been doing other things than we have with their time. And this whole notion of relative morality, I think, has been an intentional deception, and there's a lot of documentation of that that I could direct people to at another time. There's a film called Hidden Influence, which is on YouTube right now. I highly recommend it, which really documents a lot of the propaganda and the intentional fooling of Americans in the 20th century to create this whole notion of relative morality. And for those of you who haven't thought about this much, each religion has its different set of rules, and many cultures have their different set of rules. There are cultures where, you know, it's okay to stone or rape a woman who's seen out in public after 10 o'clock at night, to incarcerate people for smoking a weed that's been around, a plant that's been around on the planet for thousands of years. to bring it, you know, home a little more obviously. But the question that it brings up is, what is the source of your morality? On what ground of being do you stand beyond any social considerations for your morality? Because we interviewed actually someone who has written a book about this, For Thrive. The interview didn't end up in the film, but it's on our website. And he had taken it as far as basically that it used to be that religion was the source of ethics. But as I mentioned, each religion disagrees in some ways with other religions. And it's all, you know, based on some human's word about what God, their God supposedly said anyway. So it's a little bit of a shaky ground for action, especially because it fails the criteria of being universal. If something is truly ethical, then it should apply everywhere to everyone throughout time. And that's obviously a huge and rigorous requirement that very few philosophers or ethicists in history, in my studies, have been willing to take on. One of my favorite philosophers, Stefan Molyneux, has written what I think is probably the most important book of the 21st century so far, and it's called Universally Preferable Behavior. You know, it's not an easy read. He's written other short sort of pamphlets that are very user friendly. This is the archive. You know, this is the handbook, the definitive, the definition of what he calls a rational proof of secular ethics, where things have to hold up to the criteria of being universal. And so I highly recommend that people go to that book and just read it over and over again and share your objections, you know, with him or with us or with your friends or whatever. Get into that that debate, because this is the one through which you will find, I think, your true center, your ethical center, you know, your North Star, your compass by which to navigate, because ethics are only characterized as relative by someone who wants the power over your behavior or someone else's behavior. And fundamentally, you know, Stefan says the greatest fight in the history of humanity and of thought is the struggle for a universal morality. So I think that's really the question that lifts it off of left and right and beyond relative morality into, can you demonstrate that your logic, your reason, your evidence, your actions all transcend just somebody's particular point of view and apply universally to you as well as everyone else?
Well, that's I think where my son and I came to the conclusion is there aren't natural ethics and natural morals, and there's even there's a fine line between ethics and morals that many people don't comprehend.
Mm-hmm.
Ethics being applied morals, but
yes.
Morality in and of itself is a natural function. And beyond that, how can you define it as anything other than your applications of a subjective idea, which juxtapositions with some of the other debunking I've seen of pride, which where you say like 97% of you agree with me 97% and you get hung up on 3%. And I think that's really the crux of this, of the whole situation.
As Kimberly and I have traveled around the world with Thrive, we haven't found a single person yet who disagrees with the notion that they don't want to be violated against their will. You know, someone might want to be whipped or spanked or if that's what they're into, but they're choosing to. But no one, and it's not easy to get human beings to agree to anything, but every single person we've ever talked to does not want to be violated against their will. So maybe the universe is giving us a hint as to what the fundamental principle, or at least one, you know, very clear guideline might be for a sustainable society. But along the way, we've been shocked by some conversations with people who say, yes, they don't want to be violated against their will, but because they're more enlightened, they're richer, they're whiter, they're older, they're whatever excuse they have, they do think that they should be able to violate a certain number of other people in order to get their way, because their way is the right way. That's where exactly. We are.
And then we have to extend that out to nature. The ability of the human organism to violate other sentient, or what we perceive that maybe even as non-sentient life, has got us in this place in the first place.
Well, that you get into a very tricky area, Bill, and I'll only go briefly into it because that would be an hour just breaking that one down. But it becomes very challenging, or really paralyzing, if we try to define a universal morality beyond the realm of humans. Because I mean, personally, I'm a vegetarian. I don't want animals to be killed for my pleasure, for my eating pleasure. But there are other people who can't survive on a vegetarian diet. You know, we know Native Americans up in Alaska who absolutely depend to survive in the winter on the caribou and on seals. And anybody who cuts a piece of asparagus or walks across a lawn of grass is violating, in a sense, other sentient beings. However, I think what is really useful is to define our ethics based on the knowledge of evil. Because if a wolf brings down a deer to eat, the deer didn't like that. And it's certainly a violation of the life of the deer from the deer's point of view. But that's the give and take of nature by which, the creatures of the earth stay alive. And the wolf has no knowledge of good and evil. There's no morality going on there. If I were to do that to a human being, if I were to go out and kill a human being for pleasure or to eat, and I knew, if I were, mentally insane or so retarded that I had no clue what I was doing, then someone would need to restrain me from immoral acts. But if I understand the effects of my action on another human being's life and go ahead and do it anyway, then I am acting inethically. I mean, unethically, and I'm not acting according to a universally applicable ethic. So I think that for me, when I go beyond the human realm into blades of grass, I mean, literally, when I go out and play golf, I have difficulty at first. I have to get used to swinging the golf club, and taking a divot, because I don't even like, cutting up a bunch of grass in order to hit a ball. I try to get used to it, but it becomes too impractical to try to take this same morality and coerce other people to apply it. I think we need to depend more on our moral, what I would call moral intuition. Does this feel right? If somebody's killing for food, that's one thing. If they're being unnecessarily cruel to animals like they are in these factory farms and so forth, to me, people need to stand up and call those people out, because the people who are doing it are being unethical. That's not necessary behavior to get the result that they need. So it gets into a whole big tricky area. But for me, it's a challenge enough to just get the human morals sorted out to where we can survive in the meantime.
I think we just need to move on so we get other people to participate. And I wanted to say, I think this conversation about morality is fascinating. We have it all the time. And I love that you're having this conversation with your son.
Well, the one point I wanted to make, and that's really the point here, is the indigenous people always have reverence in whatever their actions are. And my filter, which wasn't on the poll or anything else, is, are those who are presenting this to me actually presenting it from a place of conscious reverence how their actions are impacting the all, the wholeness?
Yeah.
So let other folks talk.
Very much. And in fact, I'll say quickly, and then we're going to bring up one more question before we get to Duncan, because it's time's flying. But one of the most interesting things about how this whole issue of morality relates to the left and right and getting beyond that, to me, is that I believe that knowledge actually creates moral responsibility. And that, you know, one of the things that happens as we become informed is, what do I do with that? And I think that sometimes having an adherence to a particular political party is a way to distance ourselves from that moral imperative, because we can kind of act like, well, you know, this party's going to handle that in some way that, even though it's proven to be inept and there are immense numbers of people suffering, they're in charge of it. I'm not. And that when it comes down to actually recognizing that we are each responsible here for what we're funding, how we're acting, what we're doing, then I think that we're compelled to look more deeply into this. I know my grandmother, when I was a kid, she said, it's really simple, Kimberly. She said, with every time you make an action, imagine if everyone in the world took that action, would the world be a better place or not? And God, it was just like this constant, you know, mantra to have there, imagining the whole world doing what I was doing. And I've found it to be incredibly useful in this whole moral inquiry, because if something can't apply to everyone equally through all time, then why not? Anyway, so I just wanted to say that. But I really want to get to Duncan, because it's so inspiring in this real-time current world of ours to be having people put together coherent sources of information that, you know, are meant explicitly not to make us afraid and instead to really inform us and engage us. So I'm excited for that. I'm just going to get Mike, you want to ask?
Let me say one thing before we move on. You're just inspired by what Bill said, and particularly his conversations with his son. I want to plug my son's book. He did years of research on this and worked really hard making a clear statement of all this. You can get his book on Amazon if you're interested, ebook or hard copy. And it's called it's called The Secrets to Nonviolent Prosperity. Subtitle is The Principles of Liberty. So I highly recommend it.
Okay, so
I'm having a little bit of trouble here, Bill. I accidentally gave Bill the presenter rights, so I'll take those back. Did you want Mike up next? Who's the next person?
Yeah, Mike, I had a quick question that I thought was useful for right now, and then I want to bring up Duncan and Foster will do an introduction.
Okay, Mike should be ready. Mike, are you there? So I've unmuted Mike, but it doesn't sound like he's with us. Maybe we should move on.
Okay. Mike, if you are here, come back and we'll talk to you later. Let's go for Duncan. Foster, can you introduce?
It would be a great pleasure. So, first of all, let me read you a quote from Duncan that I was particularly drawn to. Duncan wrote, "We live in an era where the rulers fight to control what you believe using technology that would have made Goebbels drool. We live in an era where independent thought is now a radical act in itself." So Duncan is someone who obviously really believes that and has been acting on it for decades. Duncan lives in Australia, and he and his partner, Catherine Simons, have produced the magazine Nexus, which is an awesome magazine. If you haven't seen it, check it out. They've been producing this magazine since 1990. It's a bi-monthly publication, and it covers human rights, the environment, alternative health, women's rights, the new age, free energy, alternative science, and the paranormal. It's published in over a dozen languages, and it's sold in more than 20 countries. And Duncan's going to tell you more about this, but why we particularly wanted to have him on is that the Alternative News Project is looking from a lens that is beyond right and left and gathers a huge array of alternative and independent news from many, many, many genres and subcultures. And Duncan says he calls it a project because it's not just about information, but about the building of a global community through the distribution of that information, which will bring us together in a common purpose. So we want him to talk about the ANP. Duncan's someone that I would want to listen to around a campfire for days, and I'm sorry we have not a ton of time today. But Duncan, please come on and join us and share a little bit about ANP and anything else that you want to reflect. And then when we open it up to Q&A again, people can ask you questions as well.
Are you able to hear me okay?
I can hear you great. Don't see you yet.
Okay. Oh. All right. So you can hear and see me okay? This is the first time I've used WebEx, so I've got to apologize.
All right. Yeah, it looks great. Thank you.
Okay, look, thanks for your introduction, Foster, and great summation. I won't go over it except to say that I should probably explain how I got into what I do here. I was raised on a farm in Tasmania, which is the small island state at the bottom of Australia. We emigrated there when I was about three from the UK. We were a middle-class farming family. And due to circumstances, we became one of Australia's first organic farms. We developed a spiritual new age connection back in the 70s with the Findhorn community. We explored communicating with nature. So growing up in my teens, I saw for myself that what many people would call the paranormal was there and usable for people. We actually made deals with aspects of the nature kingdom. We said to the snakes, we won't kill any more of you guys. You don't kill any more of our cattle. Don't come into our house. We made deals with other species. We spread the word to other farmers and orchardists who experimented with it. And generally speaking, for the farmers who wanted to give it a go, they got tangible results, except for ants and cockroaches, but that's another story. So early on, I got exposed to the fact that if you stood up against the system, that the system would move against you. We had intimidation and coercion against our family because we had stopped putting organic fertilizers. This is in the 70s. I noticed the stories that were reported in the paper that we were involved with, the stories were misreported. So my up until that time, I worshipped doctors, policemen, government people. I worshipped the system. I totally felt nurtured, supported, and I trusted the system. So during my teen years, I got tangible personal experience to really show that what the world that I used to live in, which was the world that I perceived all my friends around me were living in, was an illusion. They were living in a manufactured fantasy, and that manufacturing was done through the distribution of information, not just news, especially through entertainment. In fact, in the last 10 or 15 years, I've made quite a lot of connections with people, you know, basically in the intelligence and security business and industries. And one of the things that I have learned more than anything is that to plant concepts, to steer society, you use fiction, you use science fiction or fictional movies. To adjust the tempo of the public's reaction and mood during campaigns, you use news and information. And we see a lot of false news being broadcast on the mainstream news, usually to trigger support for a war or a radical bipartisan action. So I grew up very much aware of the left-right duality. Interesting to watch what's going on in America and your description of it from an outside perspective. In Australia, voting is compulsory. You'd think that that would make you more interested in the political debate. But no, the divide between left and right in Australia has really dissolved. It's the description you have of growing up in one camp and not even going to socialise with the other. Yes, I'm aware of that from my own travels through America and discussions on forums. It's not like that in Australia. You still might not talk about politics here. but religion's probably a bit more sensitive than politics. In Australia, we've had the rise of the Green Party, and I've been quite outspoken against the Green Party, which surprises a lot of people because of my own environmental and human rights background. However, the Green Party in Australia, is their environmental credentials are shonky and pretty much fake. When the Iron Curtain came down in Russia, the left really had no real role anymore, and I think it saw its demise coming up. In Australia and in the UK, and definitely in the USA, but maybe not so tangibly noticeable, the left rebranded itself as Green and Green Left. So the Green movement in Australia and around the world is pretty much the revamped, rebranded and reorganized left wing. And their organizational infrastructure, which is quite coherent and can be quite disciplined, including its attendant funding and channeling. And I guess this is what I learned, and maybe I'm sure quite a few of your listeners have learned also, is that when it comes to the left-right paradigm, you have pretty much the same sources putting money into both arms. And like you say, follow the money. That's got to tell you something. So, I mean, you and the Thrive movement are all learning and are aware that the whole way to control society is to control the choices, to control the paradigms. You've been discussing controlling the left-right paradigm. More recently, the new battleground is the paradigm between science and religion, although this is a bit of a strange one because science has now become a religion, where to challenge its dogma is heresy. You've got gatekeepers who like to, you know, bring you into line. We call them skeptics, or in some cases experts. And it's an interesting direction it's going, because the last 10 or 15 years you've seen on social TV rise of shows like Mythbusters. But in the fictional sense, you've got Big Bang Theory, where the rise of the nerd has been made humorous, which is the sugarcoating of the pill, to swallow the religion of science, which is psychics are crazy, astrology is crazy. We tolerate freedom of speech and we fear anarchy. And experts and science is the new God. I feel that socially religion has been positioned to come down. I feel that to see the state media exposing religion tells you that one hand is working against the other, pretty much to change what they want you to be distracted by. I feel state-sponsored religions around the world are on the decline. Maybe not in America, but around the rest of the world they are. The replacement religion is definitely science. And the young generations are really uptaking on that at a very fast rate. Nexus always went through an interesting challenge to be, people would want to categorize it. Are you left or are you right? So I found myself early on saying, well, I step off that paradigm. It's like left and right is a roundabout. When you're on that roundabout, the world is going around and you're absorbed by those perspectives. But I'm saying to people, get off that roundabout and see it for what it is. It's a controlled paradigm. And while you're on it, you're going to go round and you're subject to the laws of that debate, which is, you know, dizziness in the end, if you follow that. One of the other controlled paradigms, which I suspect maybe a lot of Americans aren't quite twigged to, is the controlled paradigm of believing in good or evil, or right or wrong. And your discussion about morals and ethics is very interesting, and I don't want to go too far into it because of terminology and definitions. I don't want to go into what my own definitions and terminology are. But even taking a leaf out of the scientist's book, there is no such thing as an evil atom or an evil molecule, an evil tree, an evil rock. There are actions which are done by humans who make choices. Usually extreme actions, which we would call evil, there is an underlying thing running through society which we have to pull out like a vicious weed. And in doing so, it would cause a lot of self-examination. And that's the saying that the ends justify the means. Under that umbrella, people will do horrific things to other humans because they feel in the long term we're going to have a good solution. It's the same values that you talked about. We all share those values of wanting peace, security, happiness for everybody. But when you think about it, if you have to commit an act of outrage or an act of violence to achieve a goal of purity, you've lost it. You've tainted your goal forever because of the way in which you've acted. So if you want my moral compass, my ethical compass is the ends do not justify the means. And simultaneously, my personal belief is that we are all beings, we're all immortal beings of spirit who've consciously chosen to come to the earth plane of existence to learn and experience. So on that basis, I try to act in the highest integrity in terms of recognizing everybody's here by choice. Whether they know who they are or not is irrelevant. What they know in terms of intellectual information about conspiracies, the future, the past, even that's irrelevant. It's still, they're a sovereign, spiritual, immortal being. I'm not sure how much time I've got left, but I do want to segue into why I've created the Alternative News Project.
That'd be great, Duncan, if you can get to that so people can be aware of it and then ask about that, say what it is and how they can.
Okay, well, basically, pretty much most of my life, like many people, I looked around, saw problems and thought, well, how can I be part of a solution? And for me, it was clear early on that to be involved with information, collecting information and telling people things they didn't know gives them a wider range of choices. So I've been involved in alternative media for about 35 years. Involved with previous magazines before Nexus, been doing Nexus for 25 years. And pretty much the print media world is dying. The young generation are not physically buying magazines. They're getting it digitally or they're getting their news 24/7. So my model of putting out mind-breaking information every 2 months in print is still working, but it's not getting to the new market. So I've looked for a way and a model to be able to gather the information from everywhere and deliver it 24/7. The Alternative News Project basically is my grand plan and my dream, where you have all the world's non-mainstream, independent and alternative news in the one central feed. So I'm looking at giving everyone in humanity a choice. You can listen to mainstream news, which includes left, right, science, religion, politics, sport and celebrities, or you can look at all the non-mainstream news. Currently, to look at non-mainstream news, people go to their particular areas of interest, forums, Facebook pages, and they explore and circulate and recirculate. The good thing about that is there's a lot of information out there to access. The bad thing is if you are time poor, it's not a really good option. You feel a bit immersed in stuff you don't have time to check. You don't know the credibility of the source. There's a lot of rhetoric out there. There's a lot of vested interest putting information in my time in media. And this is something not a lot of people recognize. But you're probably seeing the results of it more and more as mainstream media empires start to shed journalists. What I learned in the 80s was the infiltration of not so much law enforcement, but intelligence community and think tank agents and representatives into mainstream media organizations. The control of media is very efficient. You have a central like whirlpool of news, which is information is put onto, and I'm talking mainstream. And then if you're a country like Australia, that news feed comes into Australia and you have a news director for each media empire. And we've got four or five in Australia. So four or five people dictate what everyone in Australia is going to see on the news in terms of the central pool. And you may have a bit of variation whether it's spun between left and right variations. But that's pretty much it. You've got mainstream, which is incestuous, controlled. The agents of influence I discovered in the media organizations were usually state intelligence. But surprisingly, the big church, the big state religions, especially the Vatican and some of the other big churches, had their journalists planted. The political parties had their journalists planted, and the factions within the political parties had their journalists. So when you start to shed people, you're going to shed those who you can afford to. But in Australia, we're noticing a lot of the key columnists that are left are definitely ones that I identified as agents of influence on behalf of either a religion, a corporation, or a political faction. And as we know, a lot of those go back up to the same source.
Duncan, can you say a little something about what criteria you use for including or excluding articles or videos from your ANP site?
Yeah, what I would appreciate is if you could say, you know, a little bit about how it works so people understand they can really go and how it works and the criteria, and then we can open it back up.
And if you want, Goa, while he's doing that, Goa, if you want to I could share my desktop and people could be looking at the homepage of the Alternative News Project in the meantime.
Okay, in answer to Foster's question first, after 25 years of doing Nexus and 10 years before that in media, and plus doing conferences around the world for 20 years, I pretty much met personally and got a handle on all the key researchers in all the main areas that we focus on. The Alternative News Project covers everything you can imagine, which is alternative and independent. All the alternative health modalities and healing techniques and diets, all the environmental issues, all the human rights issues, all the paranormal subjects, UFOs, crop circles, ghosts, disappearances, Bigfoot, all of that. All the ancient mysteries, ancient archaeological, all the new age osophies and isms, psychic divination. We love to keep an eye on how society is being shaped by new scientific technologies. We've got section on nanotechnology, 3D, 4D printing. We've got a big section on home, family and pets, which includes relationships. Pretty much anything which is non-mainstream. And even though some of these subjects have come into mainstream, they're still not doing it proper justice. So this is a chance where we wanted to put everything that people are missing out on into the one feed. Our target market are mainstream people with a quirk. We're definitely canvassing existing people out there who think alternatively. We're finding that a lot of people who already think alternatively are time rich and cash poor. And that's why a lot of them are out there creating Facebook group pages, forums, and flicking news items around. In terms of how do we discern who to put up and who not? Well, based on my years of experience, personal contacts, we have a list of websites which I've told uploaders not to derive from. We basically, at the moment, we're in the first phase where we are going out across the internet. And mostly with permission, we are duplicating what you see on all those alternative news aggregate sites. I've trained my uploaders to track to the original writer, the original date, and the original source of every item. And based on that information, we make a quick determination on the validity and authenticity of that story. There are certainly writers and websites out there which deliberately create satire stories, create clickbait stories, and more websites are being formed where just visiting their website drives money to the owner, examiner.com being one of them. So we're definitely in an era where even in the alternative community, misinformation is a serious concern. Dated stories, which were inflammatory from 3 or 4 years ago, are often just repackaged with a new headline, a bit of extra rhetoric thrown in, and put back on feeds purely, again, to drive up ratings and clicking. So we wade through all of that. I've got a list of writers who are more rhetoric than information. And on those particular stories, I will go to the source of the smoke and find the fire. It's usually an abstract or a science paper in a journal which somebody has jumped on and put their spin on. So we put as much information down as possible. People are encouraged to go back to the source of everything. Our intention is not to replace the alternative news on the internet, but to strengthen the websites where people originate content and news and information, places like Thrive, Wake Up World, etc. Places like rents.com are great. They've been one of my favourite aggregate sites to go to for a quick flick of the day, but they don't really originate much material. Every story there has usually come from another site. So if you are originating material, we will be sending traffic to your site and making you stronger, because we believe the more people out there who have the resources to be able to spend their time to research their little niche, their healing modality, their area of geopolitical research, etc., we encourage that. So we don't want to replace, we want to strengthen what's there. But at the same time, we recognise that having a central source of all this information, which you can easily personalise, and that's the key factor. You can personalise this right down to only being told about a crop circle as it forms via an audio alert on your smartphone. So the model is that you register at our website, we get your country, an email address, we ask for other location information, mainly because when we start delivering local content, for example, if you tell us you live in the state of Wisconsin and you've ticked the topic of fracking, anytime there's a fracking event or meeting or rally, you'll get notified only if you're in the state of Wisconsin of just Wisconsin information. So that's why we ask for some of that information, to just help us to deliver specified, personalized news to your area. The pickup on it, we're now 3.5 months into the project after launch. We have over 4,000 registered users at the moment, and it's growing every day. We have literally every day I get emails from really good quality writers, researchers, and organizations who want to reach out and cooperate. I think because this initiative has come from within the movement, from someone who's got standing and a bit of trust with Nexus Magazine, that there's a lot of confidence to support this venture. People are looking at it. They look at my track record. So people like Jim Mars, Linda Moulton Howe, John Rappaport, many of the names that you'd see across the internet have already been in contact to offer their endorsement and their support. They're driving traffic to our site. We, in turn, allow them to use any of the information on their site for research, et cetera. And that's really all I can say in a nutshell, except to say it's the most exciting project I've ever done. And at this stage, I feel it's the culmination of all my life's work, efforts, contacts, knowledge and expertise just to get it to this point. And I'd like to say publicly big thanks to Thrive Movement for recognizing on a similar spirit level another entity that's doing what you're doing. And the good news is that I feel that we're entering a time when organizations like Thrive and ourselves and others are going to be working together to coordinate more large-scale bursts of information and projects, maybe an informal think tank, which is what we often criticize the other side of using against us in terms of coordinating their strategies.
Well, I congratulate you, Duncan. It's a very timely, very visionary project, and I know a ton of work. So thank you so much for doing that and for sharing it with our group. When I was sharing, could people see the website on their screens?
Yes.
Okay, good. So if you're interested in signing up for that, there's both a free feed and a more in-depth subscription, but go to alternative newsproject.org. And check that out. It really saved you a lot of time and just got fantastic stuff on it.
Yeah.
Look, exactly. Pretty much everything you'd find yourself on a daily troll around the internet of alternative news, you'll find all that and a lot more. We're sourcing from a lot of other countries, from the UK in English language, and we've got people who want to start translating other language news stories to put on our feed, which will make it even more incredible. Because there's a lot of stuff not getting past the language barrier still on this. Hey, listen, on another tangent, how much time do we have left before I go stop?
Well, we need to go on to some other questions.
Okay.
Right.
I just wanted to throw in two things. I went to Libya in 1986 as it's a long story, but that was the time when Gaddafi was really public enemy number one, as declared by the West. While I was there, I did a lot of research into his political theory. Did you ever explore his Green Book? Because he was educated in the UK, and his whole nation represented literally. It was the first country which decided to experiment with he rejected the left and he rejected the democracy. He's actually a very astute thinker. And in some ways, it was an interesting experience to watch how Libya evolved as a administrative model, especially being a bit of a Muslim country too, although they were the least Muslim of many nations. Women were allowed to have positions in society.
But, yeah, I've heard about that, but never read the book. I'll look into it.
I think that
the other model which you should look at too, which could be slotted. I'm a bit of a renegade conspiracy theorist amongst conspiracy theories. One of the trending models for the future, which so many people have not picked, is this thing called technocracy, some people call it meritocracy. And that's where experts are the appointed rulers, as opposed to voted in political people or bloodline people. And I notice, again, the stage is being set socially, where we hate politicians more and more. We're hating the right and left paradigm more and more. And in Europe, they pretty much hate the royal bloodlines and the entitlement they have. what's going to be the replace suggestion. And we're seeing the experimentation of it in Europe with technocrats being installed in countries where their economy is faltering. They put in an economic expert. Everybody seems to be happy. Scientists, lefts, right, and religious people are all happy with an expert. So yeah. Check out technocracy and what people like Patrick Wood are talking about. There's some very interesting thoughts coming out of there.
Yeah, we've got a blog on our website on transhumanism that goes into some of that. What people need to be careful for is, what regime should replace the current regimes? No regime at all. Unfortunately, people are starting to think that way, even though it's new. Okay, thank you for your time, Duncan. That was great.
Thank you very much, and I'm going to move on and say that I really encourage this checking this out, because my favorite things, we hear from people all the time, and one of the reasons that we did recognize Duncan and carry on. So Thrive became an affiliate, and when you it helps remain a link on our site so that you can go straight to the Alternative News Project, because we're really supporting this coherence of information all in one place, and you can give feedback to us and feedback to Duncan. But my favorite thing is that it's one of the filters is to really not have it be fear-mongering, so that the information you get is done, in terms of the consciousness behind it, it's done in a way that when we said, how do we evaluate our news? And one is, does it empower us? The news here really is done in a more empowering way. So here's what we have going. I wanted to bring Joyce in. She had a question. I'm going to ask a question on behalf of Mike, whose mic wasn't working, so I'll ask his question. I want to offer a vision that I think is important for us all to hold, as well as get into a little bit about what's coming up with Thrive. So how about Joyce, can you do a succinct question or comment here, and then we'll keep on going.
Absolutely. I wanted to ask everyone on the panel, in order to make valid and crisp decisions in our lives, we each need to have as much truthful information as possible. And I feel at a very grand scale, we often don't. There's a global agenda. Can you please address that? And in particular, I'm thinking about our engagement and interaction with UFOs and other species through the elite undercurrent. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to be here, by the way. Thank you.
Thank you. Nice to see you, Joyce. Foster, do you have a response to that?
Well, it's kind of interesting, because one of the first people I would ask to answer that question would be Joyce, who probably has certainly more experience, direct experience than I do. In the ET UFO area, and sorting out from personal experience, I can say on an information level that people went after us for including ETs and UFOs in Thrive, but they also did for including 13 other different topics. It wasn't our task to try to be popular. We were connecting the dots that seemed valid and meaningful. And I personally have seen a UFO in an undisputable way, but I've never had direct contact with a visible ET, even though I have been guided by inner voices and inner visions way beyond my rational mind. But I've spent a long time just trying to put together the evidence of talking with people like Stephen Greer and James Gilliland and Lane Andrews and Joyce and many others who both had repeated direct experience, but also who have really done their homework. People like Stephen Greer, who have gathered over 500 interviews with, this isn't Betty and Barney, out in the boonies. These are high level government, military, and FAA experts who are really putting their reputations at risk, if not their lives, by telling the truth that they want to get out while they're still here. And the same thing with James Gilliland, who has a ranch up in Washington where he invites people to come and experience UFOs directly. And thousands have done so. There are more UFOs being seen there than anywhere in this country. Mainstream media has been up there. Mostly they once they see it, they refuse to report on it. Some have and actually have shown some footage. But there's hundreds of hours of UFOs responding to requests to light up and, you know, give light displays or orbs that, you know, for years, James Gilliland was recommending to photographers. He said, take a picture over here, you know, and look at what happens when you see it, either when it's developed or electronically. And then people would see orbs. Now, more and more, if people have access to these infrared goggles, they can actually see what James, who has some clairvoyant capabilities and who's been in direct contact for decades, what he could see that others couldn't. So there's just more and more solid evidence that, you know, Kimberly and I are fond of saying that intelligence is really important, but it needs to be accompanied by both an open mind and discernment. And so this is an area that is it's really stretching people, but also a really critical one, because the higher Kimberly and I have gone up in communications with the kind of movers and shakers, whether it's in media or government or, you know, security agencies, military, whatever, the higher we go, the more often we find that these people claim to be having very important and direct contact with extraterrestrial species. So it's not something that's easily written off or can be written off without putting ourselves at increased risk. And they're not necessarily all species that have our best interests in mind. Whether they feel they're benevolent or not, I think we're being visited by many species. So that's probably all I would say at this point, but I would invite Kimberly, anything you want to say, and also just Joyce, if you want to take a moment to reflect on what your answer would be, it would probably be more directly knowledgeable than mine.
I guess in particular, my reaction is I would love for people in discerning and disclosing things to take into account how it filters from the top government agenda or global agendas down to our everyday decisions about what we do in our lives and the world and how we interact with each other. So it's not just the UFO phenomenon, but all the global agenda. How does it filter down? And maybe through Duncan's website, there's an opportunity to see how it filters down from this big macroscopic in where we don't have the disclosure yet, down to our everyday decisions.
I think it's a really vital point. I'm glad that you brought it up, because I've talked to either former or even current agency members who have described to me in detail exactly how they go about their disinformation. And they say, you know, they might even put 80% of true information and then throw in a key 20% that are going to throw people off the track and make them, you know, respond in ineffective ways or end up looking silly when that 20% ends up not being true. So it's a very challenging area in which to be discerning. So thanks for making that point.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I think, again, when we were talking about how do we evaluate, you know, it's a lot, am I empowered to be a critical thinker in all of this? Or am I told that, you know, what to believe, whether it makes sense or not? And I think that that's a really important part of it. This always happens. We do these 2-hour things and we're down like to, I really want to get to a few different topics that people are mentioning, just so we get the range of that on the table before we go. So, one, in terms of on this planet at this time in Canada, Mike Lilly couldn't get his mic working, but he wanted to know about the Libertarian Party, and particularly if we saw the, you know, voting for a Libertarian Party as a viable transition technique. And he says in his home Canada, Libertarian Party is growing and the leader has basically implied that he's a voluntarist. And I'll speak to that for a moment, which is to say that, you know, transition strategies are fascinating. And what we've said in Thrive and what we believe is that the shrinking of the government to be in a protectorate role on our way, you know, as people are more and more empowered and have more and more control over money and their financials, their access to money, and people can't make it up out of nothing, and all these things are happening at the same time. You know, one thing is people just need to do the part that they're called to do. Some people just are going straight for grassroots action that really bypasses the government and political process altogether. Other people are engaged in it and find a particular representative who they feel they can trust to move us more toward the empowerment of people and the you know, access to real and true information and all of that. So for me, if that is something that, you know, you feel that is part of the calling for you to vote for a candidate who you see doing that work, I think that that's very valuable. I certainly think it's a lot more valuable than voting some party line because you hope that that party will, you know, impose your beliefs on the other side, which, you know, which is really clearly lethal. So that would be my response, Foster.
I'll just add a little bit to that, which is that, you know, libertarians are often confused with voluntarists or so-called anarchists or anarcho-capitalists. I personally try to avoid using anarcho-capitalist because it just takes two words that people hate and misunderstand and put them together and just ends practically any conversation. I prefer voluntarist. I'm sure there's a better word out there. We're working on it, but it basically refers to simply true freedom. And libertarian is used in two ways. One, it's used to describe people who just think everybody should be able to be free to do what they want as long as they're not violating anyone else's person or property. But it became a capital L libertarian as a political party. And if you're 100% voluntarist, you're not going to be a political. You're not going to believe ultimately in political parties because they're ultimately going to be spending your tax money, which was taken, you know, probably against your will. So it doesn't 100% line up. But I've spoken with Mary Ruart, who ran for president on the Libertarian ticket, also Michael Bednarik. Both of whom really have moved from being kind of minarchists, believing in small government, ultimately to becoming voluntarists themselves. They say in the liberty world that, you know, the difference between a minarchist and an anarchist is about 6 months. And I've seen that in a lot of people and in myself. There's a tendency to cling on to, well, we have to at least have, you know, the security of the state and protection of the commons and so forth. And it takes some real study to realize that that leaves the cancer of authoritarianism in the body. And there are other ways of handling all those issues better. But I don't remember his name, but I read about in Jeff Berwick's Dollar Vigilante. I read about this guy from Canada who's the head of the Libertarian Party, who is an outspoken anarchist, and he's simply using that platform to get the message out. And really, that's pretty much what Mary Ruart was doing as well. There are other people like Ron Paul, who, you know, used to be on the Libertarian ticket and realized that, you know, it's a soapbox to speak from, but it's not going to get you elected in a two-party system. So both he and Rand Paul, you know, made a lot of compromises to take a larger stage with the Republicanism. But I think the key thing is for people to actually understand the distinctions. You know, look up libertarian, look up socialist, look up communist, so that you understand what the intellectual distinctions are, because they really matter. This isn't just semantics. You know, if people like, I've been reading Chairman Mao's Little Red Book, and I, you know, bought the Communist Manifesto to really study what these people said. And it's absolutely chilling because it can even sound very good. But when you realize that it led to five times as many murders in the 20th century as fascism did, it's a very slippery slope from social democracy to socialism, to communism, to fascism. But it seems to be the direction. As soon as you empower people with that sort of false authority, it always goes that direction. So thanks for the question, Mike. Sorry we didn't get to hear from you in person.
Yeah. You know, I want to say that pulling on, you know, when we were pulling on the string of money, you know, we just noticed how economics is used, you know, to control people. And when we were first doing the research for Thrive, we're pulling on the string of money and, you know, get to the Federal Reserve and get to the whole fiat money system and get to the creation of that and the history before that. And it was just sort of this rabbit hole that, you know, resulted in what you see in Thrive. And really the same thing happened when we started pulling on the string of authority. You know, we had just been in the world of money and taken it for granted. And I thought the Federal Reserve was federal when I started, you know, and it was through my inquiry that I found out that things were really different than I had thought. And the same thing happened to me in relation to authority. We're really pulling on the string of that and going, wait a minute, how did this actually come to be that we're supposed to have other people ruling us? And can we actually get to the right place by doing the wrong thing? You know, Duncan, when you were talking about that the means and the ends will be the same, Foster, you said the same thing, that the ends will reflect the means by which we get there. So if we have a system that is fundamentally coercive, can we get to a non-coercive way of organizing as human beings? And my conclusion is that we cannot, that we actually need to develop these non-coercive ways of organizing socially in order to get to a world that can work. And that's what we're going to really start unpacking on May 9th. That's what that event is about. And I hope you'll come because we really want to be in the discussion. It's a super challenging discussion to have because one of the things, in my opinion, is that most of the people who are really educated about it are not that educated about transition strategies. They have the end goal super well articulated, and that's very important to know where we're headed. There's no question. But it can be offensive for activists to kind of go, well, wait a minute, we're so far from that. What about all the people who are so harmed and disenfranchised by the current system? How can people be helped along the way as we move and transition? So these transition strategies, we're really, you know, working to collaborate with people from all over the world to figure out what is really the best way to get from here to there. And we've identified some. We've said taking some of the best of the left, best of the right, best of independent thinking for real strategic, you know, how do we do this? And so that's one of the things we're going to dive into. One thing I would like to do now, because I think it's really important, I believe that our thoughts and our imaginations are critical in all of this, that thoughts are energy as we all are, and that the interface of that with the universe and with manifesting is key. So I would like to put out a vision.
Kimberly, before you dive into that vision, because I think that would be a wonderful thing for people to be left with at the end, I'd like to make one announcement also.
Yeah.
For those of you who are interested, tomorrow I'm going to be joining a panel sponsored by the New Earth Nation. And they're launching a series called New Earth Spotlight, a Pure Truth Symposium. And their inaugural panel is going to be tomorrow afternoon. It's called Big Brother Out of Control, When Government Declares War on Humanity. And they've assembled a panel with a lot of my heroes on it and, you know, a lot of our allies. And I want to just say some of the people who are going to be on this panel are people that I don't necessarily agree with 100%, but I tremendously respect all of these people and look forward to learning from them and sharing some things with them. But it's got Paul Craig Roberts, Noam Chomsky, Max Egan, Gerald Celente, Pippa King, who is a woman in Australia who's fighting back against the public schools activities with RFID chips and biometric information collection from the children over there. And then Paul Siles and Sasha Stone from the New Earth Nation. And it's a free webinar. It starts at 5 p.m. Pacific time. That's 8 Eastern or 8 a.m. if you're in Perth. So I hope you can join us. That should be an exciting one. Thanks, Kimberly.
Yeah, sure. And I wanted to say I'm sorry to the people. Sometimes stuff, I'm just seeing it with people's hands raised and additional questions that I couldn't get. I hope you'll add them to the comment section on the website. And I will make note of your names and try to be sure to include you next time, first thing. Nelson and Stanford in particular, and Duncan, I saw you even had your hand raised that I didn't see. So anyway, as it is, I would like to share this vision. And Goa, if you would like to put an image on the screen, I encourage you to close your eyes and actually allow yourself to vision the words that I have. And if not, then look at this lovely picture to just kind of remember that we're on a path and we really are going somewhere. So I want to thank you all and say that this is my vision for moving beyond left and right. Imagine that the bounty of human connection and planetary healing that once seemed impossible is now manifest everywhere. That what began as a quiet rumble of dissatisfaction turned into a transformative rush of creativity. And imagine that each and every one of us was instrumental in having this be so. Imagine the quiet inner discomfort we have each experienced as separation from one another no longer binds us. And instead, we realize that we are not nearly so alone as we had been led to believe. Imagine we learn to listen differently, to tune into people who think differently, to listen for what we share as values, and explore skillfully how we might each have something to offer. Imagine that we no longer want to waste our time confused about which compromise of our morality is better when no compromise is needed. We recognize that, like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, we have been wearing the red slippers all along. That the angst in our hearts was the sign that we are in fact meant to be true to ourselves, and no one has or will ever have the right to take that from us. Imagine feeling secure enough that when people offer accurate accounts of our history, we are empowered to find our own part in seeing that it never happens again. And we turn away from the false stories, the false choices, the sources of manipulated news that leave us afraid of one another and disconnected from ourselves. And instead, we insist on something different, something that expands our worldviews, includes more perspectives, empowers us to know and believe in ourselves, and unleashes the creativity that is our true birthright. Imagine we share honestly about the power and clarity we feel when we stop violating ourselves in the name of what is expected of us. Imagine, like waking up from a long, disturbing dream, we gradually re-inhabit our true selves, and we are no longer afraid, not afraid of the inner calling that we had been trained to suppress, not afraid of each other. We forgive ourselves for having fallen prey to a distorted reality, and we forgive each other. We know that no one can take our purpose from us. And with that confidence, we find that listening to another perspective becomes interesting instead of threatening. Imagine at the next family gathering, instead of avoiding the person whose worldview is most different from yours, you decide to ask him what he most values in his own life. And somewhere in that conversation, you discover that you both want similar things. That almost all of us want similar things, and an expanded understanding emerges. Imagine we no longer allow our own biases to prevent us from knowing each other. Imagine the old news falls away from atrophy, from people no longer buying it, and new sources emerge that reflect an ever-expanding sense of how many people share common values, and an ever-expanding appreciation for the different ways people have to manifest those values. Imagine you feel energized in your body, challenged in your mind, excited emotionally, and connected with practical skills offered to help navigate our differences respectfully. Imagine open-source news that people everywhere feed into, with robust, collaborative, multi-generational, cross-cultural discussions. Imagine news reports that explore true solution strategies that offer real ways out, so that those once in need of help become the helpers, and each subsequent generation needs to spend less time healing and can instead spend more time creating. Imagine that when you tune in, you can be assured that you will feel more alive, more capable of engaging in a way that calls forth the best of who you are and the best of what you're here to do. Imagine that the most constricted time in human evolution gives way to the most expansive, where boundless creativity launches humanity into an unprecedented cleanup, empowered by our knowing that we can do this, that in fact, we are already doing this. Thank you.
Thank you, Kimberly. Very beautiful.
My pleasure. I love visioning. Yeah. I want to thank you all for joining in today. It really means a lot to us. Sometimes I think here we all are on our weekend gathering together because we care so much, and it means so much for us all to know that we're in this together. And I also really want to thank Duncan, whose work inspires me deeply.
Always the hardest part for me is all of the people that we didn't get to. Maybe we should do a 6-hour one instead. But thank you for your participation, for your listening. You know, we don't all have to agree with one another. We do need to listen to one another. So thank you for that and for your input. This is, you know, we're early on in this conversation, and we're going to be diving deeper and deeper into these issues in Thrive Together. So, you know, tell your friends who are interested that we would value their input into this think tank. You know, this is where we're going, and everybody's input really helps. So, you know about our event on May 9th. We welcome you to come participate in that one. We'll dive deeper into Liberty. Those of you we didn't get to this time, we hope to get to you the next time, and feel free to write to us in chat or on the website at the subscriber portal. Offer whatever resources. We had a fantastic response to the blog we put out, and we've collected all of the resources that were suggested, and we're going to be adding that to the blog. So it's an exciting ongoing think tank, and you're the ones that make it so. So I appreciate it.
Yeah. Shall we open it up for our hearing everybody?
Yeah, we'll open up there. We'll unmute everybody for about a minute so people can just take their time, and it'll be a cacophony, but we welcome your salutations or anything that you want to say in saying goodbye to the whole group.
Okay, I'll unmute everybody now.
Yes, please.
Thanks, Foster and Kimberly.
Thank you, Foster and Kimberly.
A lot of
really great information.
Yeah,
I really enjoy it.
Night from Germany.
Robert.
Thank you. See you tomorrow.
Thank you.
Hello from Hawaii.
Goodbye, Sky.
All right.
Thanks, Jack.
Bye
from Texas.
Jared and Jeanette.
Bob and Lynn in South China, Maine.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bob and Lynn.
That would be somebody I would be interested in a dinner party.
That's
why
they make a garden. Find a garden and Foster and Kimberly.
Thanks, Bob, for sharing it.
Oh, wow.
Thank you, Robert.
Thank you so much, Foster and Kimberly. This is Randy.
Hi, Randy. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, this is Gloria, and I really appreciate that. Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Bye, Maud.
Thank you.
Thank you, Foster, Kimberly.
Yes.
Thank you, Sperry.
Appreciate it.
Hey.
Thank you, Foster and Kimberly. Love you all. So beautiful.
Thank you from Lincoln Justice.
Thank you. Bye, Lincoln. Okay, bye everyone.